Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking Angrynomics. Angrynomics. Martin, I remember Freakonomics, and you kind of do freak me out a lot.
I can do angry as well.
Oh, God. yeah, that is kind of the pattern. We're delighted. Look, we're doing this live. It's great to be joined by an audience of our supporters. And the reason we do that is because if you are chipping in, we try to give back. Thanks so much for the support, guys. It's well worth it. I think it's what keeps us going. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The price of a cup of coffee, and it really makes a difference. Anyway, enough of that. We're delighted to be joined live by Eric Lonergan, who is a hedge fund manager, an economist, and co-author of the new book, Angrynomics. Now, he's authored several books, but we're here specifically to talk about your new book with Mark Blythe. And I'm going to just ask you straight off the bat, because it's written as a dialogue.
Yeah,
and I don't know. Like, I'm gonna get myself in trouble with people now. But I remember Malcolm Gladwell and Bill Simmons almost getting away with this email chain that became a book. I think of a dialogue about things. And this is how it seemed. It literally read like that to me. Like, you know, backwards and forwards, and a backwards and back. Do you want to just look? First of all, just give the listeners an idea. What is the concept behind Angrynomics?
Okay. So the basic concept is, as you said, my sort of day job involves economics. That's my training. And Mark is a professor of political economy in America. He's also from Dundee, so he sounds like Shrek, which is his main attraction. And he's very, very thoughtful. Anyway, the pair of us became friends about 10 years ago. And we discovered we had a lot in common, and we thought, like most of you, we argued about what the hell's going on in the world. How do we explain what's happening in our politics? What should we do about it? And we had a few ideas, and then we thought, right, let's write a book about it. And because, like yourselves, we like talking, but if you're like me, we're also a bit lazy. We thought, let's just have a massive argument and record it all, and then transcribe it. And then, lo and behold, we've got a book. So that was the basic premise. But then we were about halfway through, and Mark said, are we going to say anything about anger? And that was really a key point, I think, for both of us, because all of a sudden I thought, we have to say something about anger. It's kind of obvious. And yet, if you're anything like me, I knew nothing about anger other than the fact, like, it's one of those fascinating things that we all know what it is. Even kids know what anger is. And yet, when I thought about it, why do people get angry? You know, what function does it serve? What does it tell you about a person? Is it good or is it bad? What do you do if somebody gets angry? There, I had no idea. And so we kind of stopped the book halfway through and said, let's go back to the drawing board. Let's think about anger. And let's read lots of research and see if we can understand it. And then let's come back and have a look at the book again. And that was, it was a kind of fascinating journey, to be honest.
And you frame it in a way like you find anger falls into two camps, a righteous anger and a tribal anger, for want of a better term. And you obviously, you give stories and you give examples of how these things, but I suppose at its very basic, it's almost you're yellow, you're black, your team is yellow, your team is black, and we don't know why, but we don't like you, is one form.
Yeah.
You do refer to the righteous anger as in something that can be positive.
That's right. So if you look at, if you do a Google search, or you went onto Google Scholar, which is all the academic research, and you put in anger, you'll find lots of articles written on anger in loads of different areas and disciplines. There's neuroscience, psychology, moral philosophy, political science. And the main idea in all of those disciplines is the idea of people getting angry because they witness something unfair happening. So that's where, if you go all the way back in the earliest philosophy on this, which was Aristotle, he talks about anger as an appropriate response to the observation of injustice. So somehow we evolved whereby, if you think about it, and you're in a situation, if you see something appalling happening, anger is a kind of a threat. It sort of says, you better stop doing that, or we're going to do something about it. And to make that live, There's a great CNN interview. I don't know if you saw with Cornel West.
I did, yeah.
He's talking about, you know, and he's sort of about the Black Lives Matter matters movement, and I think he goes all the way back to the civil rights era, Martin Luther King. But one of the things he says is that what would it say about our society if we could witness that on our screen, that level of police brutality, and we do nothing about it? And that's Aristotle's idea, that anger is almost tells you you've got a moral compass. So that's the kind of the good, whether it's good or not depends, but at least it's a signal that we care, that we give a shit about things in a good way, because we're not going to tolerate injustice. The second aspect, though, was this tribal anger that you mentioned. And this really came, I started to see this at football matches, and it goes back to this point of, you know, what color is your shirt? And I remember I went to see a football game in North London, and I used to sit with the most intense fans. I always now, whenever I go to watch a football match, I always want to go where the hardcore fans are, because they're the most. That's where the most atmosphere is.
Right? Oh yeah,
and
stay away from the ultras.
Exactly. You go to where the ultras are, and just watch the behavior. And that was really interesting, because there's always a minority, particularly if it's football, who go and get really angry. And I asked myself, why do they pay good money, often in the pouring rain, to go and watch it, not always a good game of football, just to get angry? And the interesting thing is they get angry with their own team, and it becomes about loyalty. And this is where we suddenly realize that anger plays this role as a kind of loyalty regulator. You've got to be on our side. And these are the two faces of anger. So you've got this kind of moral sense of injustice, which is the anger of angels. And then you have this tribal energy, which is a very, very different force, which is the anger of devils.
In the book, you refer to saying basically, you know, you're an economist is your stock in trade. And yeah. You say that one of the more memorable phrases, I suppose, is when the system crashes, economics can become angry-nomics. Obviously, we're talking from an Irish perspective. The global financial crisis was, by definition, global. But we took on a serious amount of the financial burden and the bank debt of that. You do refer to it about central banks, and you refer to, you know, what was the system. You know, we thought we had the end of history. You know, we actually thought we had seen everything. Sure, we've dealt with it now. But one of the main points you make, though, is we never actually reformed anything after that.
Well, that's right. We did some reforms in the sense that we did improve the banking system. So we made the banks a lot stronger and more robust and regulated them a lot more aggressively, rightly so. But the other things didn't change. So the things I list that didn't really change is we didn't put any infrastructure in place to prevent recessions. And if you think again about the pandemic, I would say the pandemic wasn't predictable, but it's not a surprise that we're having a recession. On average, you have a recession once a decade. Now, I don't understand why it's after a century of analysis, why don't we have a system in place that means when a recession strikes, we protect the most vulnerable in our societies? We've got the financial resources to do it. It's just a question of being prepared and organized. So that's one thing we didn't fix. We didn't fix recessions. We didn't really do anything about wealth inequality. So the argument in the 80s and 90s and the sort of early 2000s was, well, the system's very unequal, but don't worry because, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, then we realize, well, no, because that there was one hell of a tidal wave and a crash, in which case let's do something about the fact that wealth is so poorly distributed, again, to give more protection to people in their daily lives. And yet nothing's been done about wealth inequality. And the third thing I'd say, which has been growing for a long time, is that everybody's concerned about the future of our planet, particularly young people, but I think it's even broader than that. And the challenge I would put down to the political class is, you know, where are the ideas? Who's come forth and said, this is what we're going to do to prevent recessions causing harm. This is what we're genuinely going to do to affect inequality. And this is going to how we're going to make a big dent in the environmental problem on a 5 or 10 year view. in a positive way, in a way that people can see genuinely good changes in their lives. So those are the kind of components that we think we've just ignored and put our heads in the sand. And that's what's concerning, because that's the kind of rumbling. And people want an answer. And the people who are coming in to motivate people are tribalists and nationalists. And one needs to have a kind of optimistic, positive vision that addresses those legitimate concerns that people have.
Is the box of neoliberal too small to look at those issues that are literally outside the scope of their box?
I mean, I think, yeah, definitely. So I think economists, and I think of this as my own training, I think have had a huge influence in public policy, right? So people talk about competitiveness, you know, unemployment, all of those terms, growth, GDP per capita, all of that terminology, which most of the politicians in power have just taken for granted, that those are all the right objectives. And those are just are very simple economic concepts. And you know, I remember when I started out studying labor economics, and we just thought, you know, you should deregulate the labor market because you'll have a lower rate of unemployment. But nobody really thought, well, if you make people's jobs less certain, how's that going to affect their stress levels? How's that going to affect anxiety? What's that going to do to mental health? What's that going to do to families bringing up kids? Whereas economists have a very simple set of references. We just think, well, what happens to inflation? What happens to unemployment? So in that sense, I think you're absolutely right, is that in a way, neoliberalism, Martin, is a narrow set of priorities and a very narrow way of viewing the world.
Does that mean that, or would it be better to GDP to include other factors like well-being, health of a nation, mental health, other, you know, a good public transport system, all of that should be included in GDP calculations?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, GDP per capita should never be an end in itself. It's almost obvious. We shouldn't even really need to say that. And we care. I hopefully this is something that comes out of the pandemic. It's impossible to imagine something else that's forced people really to reconsider the whole way society is organized. You know, when Keynes was writing 80 years ago and he projected what GDP per capita would do, he assumed we would all have a huge amount of leisure time. He did not expect people to be working more hours than they were working 50 years ago. We haven't really rethought, you know, how we want to live our daily lives. And I also think we've just accepted the system when we can do way, way better. I mean, the level of wealth inequality is unnecessarily extreme. And we could find very clear solutions to make recessions far less harmful. And that's what the final third of the book really goes into this, because I do think it's a failure of the mind and a failure of ideas.
Just on the, okay, so just coming out of the pandemic, we've seen the race to go back to normal. And then I've seen actually, you know, we'll talk about some of the suggestions you guys make, and they're really good. But there's a couple of other things I've seen. Obviously, in the in the US, Joe Biden is running Build Back Better is going to be his tagline as he runs. And that at least sounds better than back to normal in many regards. It's weird where Joe Biden might be the most progressive American president ever if he gets in, which is not saying much, but nonetheless. And then, like in Ireland, we have the pandemic payment, the unemployment benefit. I've seen people argue for, you know, oh, well, the childcare facilities, and we need to do this. And for one of the statistics, and I think DJ who was on here was telling me the other day, I put up, it was for every dollar you put in, one of the things I read, you got $4 back into the economy by supporting childcare. He told me it was nearly double that in one of the other studies. The idea, though, of fairness. And then fairness in terms of anger, like you talked about the Panama Papers in the book, you talk about all of these things that light a fire under people. Is it the fact that we've access to the information now that we know about these things that means we can, that means we push back for the first time, probably in ways that we couldn't have done during the 80s, 90s, or maybe I'm just bigging up my own time.
I think that's true. I can't remember which of the kind of African-American leaders was saying this, but one of them was making this point, is that it's not that it's not that there's been an increase in police brutality towards African-Americans. It's that we can see it now. It can't be hidden. And I think that's true of an awful lot. That was a very interesting argument. One of the great development economists, Amartya Sen, the Indian development economist, used to make this argument. One of the benefits of democracy in India was actually the media, because people could tell what was happening in another part of their country. And so there was a greater sense of solidarity. They wanted to help people if they could see them suffering on their screens. So I do think that's one of the positive. I'm broadly somebody who tries to see the more positive side of things, and we're all very conscious of all of the negatives associated with social media and the internet, etc. But I think that's human beings. You know, if we evolved to rest on our laurels, we'd never have left the caves, right? We're always looking at the thing that's gone wrong, the problems with it. But I think the access to information and research resources and learning it is something phenomenal. So in a sense, I view a lot of the lack of tolerance of injustice to be a good thing, because it galvanizes us to try and do something about it.
Do you see the main problem is to reduce that gap between rich and poor, between haves and have-nots? Is that the key to moving economies and countries forward? As you said, we're kind of stoic. We're kind of stuck in this neoliberal moment for the last 50 years, and we need some way to move past it. Is reducing inequality that key?
Well, let me explain why I think it's important, because it's a slightly different perspective to just simply redistributing. So what I think is that there's almost a trade-off in the whole system, which is between insecurity and uncertainty and the benefits of technology. So technology can deliver us phenomenal benefits, as we've all seen, whether they're medical advances. But in all of these huge, the very fact that we're able to do this, the way we've responded to the pandemic, people working from home, communication if you travel abroad or with you know, elderly relatives, we've benefited hugely from all these forms of technology. But technology creates huge uncertainty in our lives, because it means our environment is changing all the time. So my skills might become redundant. I might lose my job. My business might fail. Wages are being affected. So technology creates all of this uncertainty. So really, in a sense, the policies that we try to look at are about providing people with forms of insurance, protecting people against the uncertainty and insecurity that our system creates. So I think it's good to have a lot of competition between firms, because that means, you know, good firms do better than bad firms. There's an incentive to do research and development and have technological innovation. To be honest, I think it's broadly a good idea to have a proper labor market, because then you know, wages go up when there's a shortage of skills. Wages go down, there's an incentive to get trained. You know, you need to allocate labor workers need to move between good businesses and bad businesses, right? So there is going to be uncertainty in our lives. But if we're going to live with that uncertainty, let's have some protection against it. And the thing is, you've got, you know, 80% of the population in most developed countries have virtually no assets. Assets provide you with some security and protection. So that's where I think you can take a relatively small amount of the value of assets and distribute it to quite a large share of the population. And it would just make an enormous difference to their sense of ownership. They have a stake in the system, and they have some protection against the rainy day or against insecurity.
There was one of your points, and I'm going to come to it now, but it actually reminds me of post the crash, when Yanis Varoufakis was running around as Greek finance minister, getting battered and pilloried from all and sundry. When it turns out much of what he said, he was right about in the medium term, even, never mind the long term. But one of his suggestions, I remember him saying, was that this polarization that we've seen, which has led to things like Brexit, which has led to things like Trump and populism, and whatever populism means now, because it certainly doesn't mean what it meant in the late 19th century and all the rest of it. But nonetheless, when you look at these things, he said, people who are the most needy, the people who need to be bailed out, when they get their check or whatever their payment is, have it signed by the ECB, have it signed by the EU, and watch polarization go away in the morning. this brings me on to one of what is probably the big idea of the book, and it's the sovereign wealth fund. It's a big idea because it's funny. You're now a hero of the left, and I don't think you ever set out to be that. But the idea,
I don't mind as long as it happens.
But I also you know, I've looked at it, and it's something that we've discussed on this podcast before. Yeah. Do you want to just give the listeners an idea of what we mean by this sovereign wealth fund and how we can bring it into the realms of reality?
Well, this is the thing, is that one of the simplest of points I'd like to come out of the book that I hope people remember is that we're the most fortunate generation of people in one very, very simple way, which is we have the lowest cost of borrowing in modern economic history, right? Now, what does that mean? It means the Irish government, take an example, can borrow at a zero interest rate for 20 years. Now, as an economist, you immediately scratch your head because you go, that's a kind of gift from God. Because what that means is the Irish government can go out and borrow at fixed interest rates, right? So fixed at zero for 20 years. Any investment the Irish government makes with a positive return makes money for the state, right? That's virtually a license to print money. Now, most economists will go rushing back to the textbook. What should we do? They go, infrastructure. The problem with infrastructure is, you know what it's like. The politicians get involved. The planners get involved. People say, not in my backyard. It takes, everybody argues about it. You never get it done. Or if you can get it done, but it takes you forever. What we're saying is, just raise the money, issue the bonds, and go to a third party. Just put out to tender to asset managers, one of these big firms like a BlackRock or Blackstone, and say to them, you generate me, the Irish government, a 2-6% return on average for the next 15 years. And if you look at it, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund has done that. The Singaporeans have done that. It can't be beyond the wit of global capital to generate us a positive return. What that means, and it's just compound interest, in 15 years' time, you can repay the debt and you've still got the assets because the value of your assets has doubled. And because of zero interest rates, your debts are unchanged. Now, you can only argue with that if you don't believe in compound interest.
It sounds like the magic money tree that we discuss quite a lot. It sounds very much like the magic money tree. And, you know, 15 years to maturity is not bad for any tree.
Well, there you go. I mean, is it a magic money tree? I mean, there's the other very simple thing in economics that I think is one of the simplest, most obvious points, and yet we don't really want to accept it because it feels counterintuitive, is we live in societies that print money every year. Right? That's where those euros in your pocket or your wallet come from. That's where the digits in your bank account come from. We create it out of thin air. We do it in a controlled way because if you create too much of it, you have inflation. Well, what if you're faced with deflation, which is where we are now? That means you can print as much of it as you want, right? Because the only problem with printing it is inflation. So in a sense, that's the opportunity. There are other complicated reasons, to be honest, as to why interest rates are zero. But in a way, that doesn't matter. The point is, Ireland, all developed countries today, with a few exceptions, can borrow at 20 years at zero nominal interest rates after inflation is virtually a negative real rate. That is a gift. That is a huge opportunity. And we're saying just do 15-20% of GDP, buy the assets. So your balance sheet, your net assets don't change, to be technical. And then if you compound, if you make money over 10 or 15 years on average, repay the debt, and then give ownership of that pool of assets and inheritance to 80% of the population who don't have assets. Give them a stake in it.
Which is similar to some of the ways they've done it in Singapore, which is ways they've done it in some of the Nordic countries.
Yeah.
We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just reinventing the means, I suppose. Some of these countries managed to pile together money from, maybe it was fossil fuels that it enabled them to build that. And I always make the point that Ireland doesn't have fossil fuels. We have the best Wavin pipes in the world. And what I mean by Wavin pipes are, it's how we filter money through Ireland. It's our tax avoidance network of Wavin pipes that we charge a facilitation fee. You know, it's not so much a taxation. It's a facilitation charge. But here's the crux for, and the problem with this now is that I come back and I say, well, yeah, but I need the infrastructure, Eric. I need the houses.
Sure. But listen, I'm all in favor. It's when people say to me, but it doesn't solve this, doesn't solve. That's absolutely fine. Mm. You have the power as an Irish state to build infrastructure. You can do what you want. You have all of those powers. I'm just saying to you, I'll tell you what. I want to make a difference to inequality, and I want to do it in 6 months. Let's do this, and let's give ownership immediately in the fund to 80% of the population. So suddenly they think, you know what? Somebody's looking out for me, and I've got a stake in global capital. So if the global capitalist system continues to generate a 6% return, I'll have a retirement fund or an education fund or a housing fund. That's all. By all means, everything else that's sensible, it's you can go ahead and do it. But listen, can I tell you about another idea as well in the book that I think is very important? It's very simple, which is what I want central banks to do is every time there's a recession or they think there's going to be a recession, I don't want them to start buying the stock market and buying up the bond market and buying corporate bonds. And the reason they do that is because that's what they were set up to do in the 1800s. And again, just go on Wikipedia and Google the first central bank. I don't know if it was, I think it might have been the Swedish central bank. They were not set up to stop recessions. That's not what we set them up to provide liquidity to banks, in other words, to provide money in the money market and to buy government bonds. That's what we set them up to do. And they're using exactly the same tools today. Now, who would design an institution more than 200 years ago and then to have the same function today when it's got a totally different set of responsibilities? So my question to them, and to be honest, there's growing support for this. So it is no longer a mad idea. You've now had, you know, Stanley Fischer, who's the former head of the Israeli central bank, a Swiss central bank governor, who supported the idea. What I'm saying is, first sign of a recession, just transfer 1,000 euros to every adult citizen in the Eurozone. Everyone, you get a bank account and designate the banks. And so you can you call it a perpetual loan. You don't have to worry about that. I call it a zero coupon perpetual loan. That's just jargon. It's actually just a transfer. And as long as the recession continues, you keep on transferring 1,000 euros until it's over.
So helicopter money. Helicopter money.
We don't use that phrase on this show.
But again, listen. It's such a simple idea, right? The economics of it are absolutely robust. It's much more effective than negative interest rates, quantitative easing. All of the evidence, much more supportive of it. Here's the only obstacle it faces is we haven't done it before. But then, how do you ever do something for the first time, right? We've never done it before. But here's the question to me. What would that do to European solidarity?
I would fix it overnight.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine if you're a Southern Italian family, and you've had a decade of no growth, you got youth unemployment of 30%, and you were getting a check from the European Central Bank, which would make a big, big difference.
And I agree with you insofar as that these are absolutely, it helps, and the money goes where it's needed as opposed to into the system. Which brings me back to the book again, because you talk about after the crash, you refer to one of the points you refer to is the economy as a computer system that's never got an upgrade. And you were more or less saying we're playing with Windows 98 and we're trying to work on 2020 models.
That's exactly right.
Can I ask on that, does this require, people think we're radical. I don't think we're very radical. We're just a bit more to the left. But do we end up then with a situation whereby we need to actually convince more people to take this big step? How do we do it, Eric? Simple question, I suppose.
Okay, so here's what makes me optimistic is that we face the same problem in virtually every country in the world. That's a lot of countries. In my view, one or two of these countries is going to do it. And then we're going to look stupid for not doing it. So that's, when I get asked in my day job, with as an investor, what do people worry about most? I always say people worry most about looking stupid.
Yeah.
Right. And when I say things like, why don't you just transfer cash to everybody's bank account? They're just terrified because they don't want to look stupid.
You can't do that, they'll say.
That's right. Somebody else does it and it works. You look stupid for not doing it. So what we need is somebody to break ranks and show that it can be done. And then it becomes accepted. And before we know it, everybody's doing it.
I think we will face, somebody will eventually do it because that's the way the world is going. Yes, of course they will do it eventually. I think we face extra obstacles in Ireland. We have a punitive mindset. You can't give people money for nothing and, you know, everything has to be paid for and we have to take our medicine. We have so many euphemisms for let's keep the rich rich and the poor poor. I think we have extra obstacles to overcome there that maybe some of the Nordic countries may not have. How do we get past that mindset in Ireland?
Well, I think if you look at, you know, I have some, well, a lot of this is to do with framing, right? I think framing, and this is the challenge, you know, I think with policy ideas, Mark, my co-author, he hates the word policy, right? He says, we don't have policies. We just want to rearrange the furniture, right? Because the furniture changes the relationships, changes the conversations. And I think you can, it hugely depends how you frame these things. So the Americans are the experts at framing, at describing something in a clever way that makes it more palatable. Right? So Bush, and you know, you mentioned the political spectrum, right? Bush did helicopter drops in the sense that he gave cash a handout, but he didn't say, I'm going to give you a cash handout. He wanted to make it somehow deserving. So he said, I'm going to call it a tax rebate. Oh, well, yeah, I mean, well, a tax rebate now. You're giving me back my hard-earned taxes. That's a completely different thing. It's exactly the same. I mean, he just handed money out, right? But he called it a tax rebate. So we just need to think up of clever terms for these things, whether it's a data dividend.
It's sales.
I mean, I think it's just framing. You know, look, it's in all of our interests. Nobody is to blame for losing their job during a recession. I mean, that's blindingly obvious, or for losing their income. They didn't cause the recession. And it's in all of our interests to protect people's incomes and livelihoods. And it's not a handout. It's not, you know, it's not like it's going to be there forever. It's there until we're back on our feet. And I think the same with, you know, giving people an ownership. You know, I like to call it a national inheritance. Because people don't want inheritance is the most unjust ethically. Because you, if you inherit something, you haven't earned it.
Yeah.
You don't deserve it. And yet people, you know, people hate the idea that they can't get their inheritance. Well, then let's have an. Let's. Why can't we broaden the scope of the inheritance?
And we only saw this in the last 24 hours in Ireland, where one of the things that was undone, I'm going to call it a token win for the Greens. Token win for the Greens. They claim that the capital gains tax that the government were going to bring from 33% to 20% was scuppered in favor of a more equitable tax that will benefit more people. That is the thing. There's just a couple of points. One point here is a good point around childcare in the scenario where you talk about giving people £1,000. We always see, particularly in Irish society, but in societies around the world, women and children suffer worse in recessions. That's you know, when we look at our housing situation, our homelessness situation, it's women and children predominantly. You know, how do we you know, in your scenario where everybody gets £1,000, how do we make those people the most vulnerable? Can they get more, or is it a flat £1,000?
Well, I mean, there are, of course, lots of other forms of support that I am hugely in favor of continuing with. So I'm not viewing this as a substitute for a social safety net. I think we should have a highly effective social safety net. There need to be, and we need all of the mechanisms to fight poverty, to provide education, to provide childcare, and to support. For me personally, single mothers, I think as well, are a group that deserve a huge amount of support. Anyone who's tried to bring up children knows that. And so I'm all in favor of as much support, but really this is specifically trying to target the problem of recessions. Mm. And I think one of the advantages of making an equal transfer is there's almost no argument about it. I mean, in an ideal world, you target it at the most needy. But what I found to be the case is the part of the problem can be is that when people want to target specifically, it's not quick enough and it becomes an obstacle to implementing it. So when you think there's a lot of political opposition to this idea, my feeling is Germany can't object to it. Savers can't, you know, you're treating everybody exactly the same way. As it happens, the reality is, you know, to somebody who's struggling to get by, €1,000 is probably going to mean a lot more than someone at the high end of the income distribution. So it's by no means is it perfect, but it's a huge improvement on what we have currently.
We had a our previous finance minister to this finance minister, and our finance minister has served quite a long time now, but we did have a previous finance minister who told us that we would never again have boom and bust. And that's kind of looking unlikely now, in all fairness. Is this the way to end boom and bust, or to at least mitigate the worst aspects of boom and bust?
I mean, I think if there's one thing we've learned slightly shambolically through the pandemic is that in an environment of no inflation, which is the one that prevails, the ability of the state to provide support in a recession is phenomenal. And in a sense, what's been very interesting, again, I'm speaking as a professional economist here, is this recession has been very unusual because we caused it ourselves intentionally. So we almost made a decision. So the government entering lockdown everywhere said, we're now going to cause a recession. So let's prepare the support mechanism. And we've seen how much support we can provide. My criticism would be, why the hell did we waste the last 10 years not thinking about how to do that? So we should have in place a contingency plan that we can, that's just there to take off the shelf as soon as a problem hits. So whenever a recession strikes, we immediately have a structure in place that allows us to support household income.
So you're arguing for a more dynamic state, actually. That's what you're arguing for, in a sense.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. You're looking for people to, where we have these defaults. Like, I mean, one of the best suggestions I heard was someone saying that people who are on the pandemic unemployment benefit returning to work should be allowed to keep that, and then the employer only bridges the gap up to the living wage. And all of a sudden, you know, so the employer has to pay less, the state continues to pay until everybody's back on their feet. There are a myriad of good ways to do this. This is a really good question I got sent in by one of our listeners, but it goes back to the whole issue around what you would call righteous anger and the right to be outraged, frankly, and how we turn that into positive action and then positive action into results. We've seen in Ireland some of the big changes that we've seen have been led by from grassroots levels. We've seen, you know, civic society. We've seen changes in same-sex marriage and the likes of that. Is there space in your model there to you know, encompass grassroots movements as opposed to, because this is also quite, what your idea is kind of top-down as well?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And I've been thinking a lot about that over the last few weeks, actually, because it's one of the areas of kind of feedback on the book. And what I like about the thing I would say or suggest to any grassroots movement, I've thought about this a lot, is have a clear practical objective. So because one of the criticisms I would make, for example, of the environmental movement, which is an extraordinary grassroots phenomenon, has changed the way the world thinks. I mean, if you think the Green Party or environmental activists 30 years ago were a tiny minority, they've changed the way everybody thinks. But the challenge I put to most people is, if you said there's, what is the one thing they want you to do? That's not clear. So that movement is absolutely, so you mentioned like same-sex marriage, for example. Well, if you want to change a constitution, that's a very clear practical goal. So we're going to focus our sense of injustice because we want this action. And in a sense, that's what the book's trying to do. Is I'm just saying, if you have a grassroots movement that says these things are unacceptable, this is what you should push for. You should say, we're not going to stop, you know, until you've totally transformed our energy system so it's sustainable energy. We're not going to stop until you've built a national wealth fund and distributed ownership to 80% of the population. we're not going to stop until the effects of recession are mitigated. Do you see what I mean? Mm. So I think a movement has to happen. I think this is one of the things that Barack Obama, I thought it was a very astute thing, as he said to the Black Lives Matters movement, is he said, what's your goal? Like, because if you think the civil rights movement, they wanted legislation. I think that's a very important aspect to me. We need to focus our anger, our righteous anger, on specific things. And that makes it much more powerful.
That's a very good point. It's also a difficult one to define. I'm thinking of it in climate action. I mean, you'd literally need a list of priorities, and you know, it's a very long list, a very, very long list.
Yeah, but at least we can turn around and say, well, I want to actually see X amount of electricity generated is now.
I think that's what we need. Actually, I would say we need to go away, as people who care about this and who think about this stuff, we need to come up with three simple, done very quickly, and that can be explained to people. And we literally say you shouldn't rest until your politician says he's going to deliver on that, or she is going to deliver on that. But that's the challenge for people who are thinking, because you've got to get simple, effective policies. That personally, I mean, I would say this, but that's one of the things I think is powerful about the National Wealth Fund. Like, you can do it in 6 months and you can make a difference.
And the benefits are clear.
Sorry?
Yeah. And the benefits are very clear.
The benefits clear. And that's how we got it. We've got to, that's the challenge for these. You know, if you think like what Obama did very well, and credit to him, he doesn't get enough credit. Obamacare, you know, medical insurance for all. That's a piece of legislation. It matters to people's lives. And it's clear what your objective is. And I think that's where the challenge for me is for politics that's going to be to counteract the populism. It needs to make a difference. It needs to be simple and effective.
That was our interview with author, hedge fund manager, economist Eric Lonergan. His book, which he co-authored with Mark Blythe, Angrynomics, is available pretty much anywhere. And we just want to thank him for his time. If you want to hear the full length of this podcast, including the Q&A session with our supporters, head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I just want to say thanks to everybody for listening. Talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.